Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and our guest today, again, for the third time here in the show, is the amazing Ellie Blum, SaaS researcher and strategist, and we'll be talking about jobs to be done interviews today. This episode is brought to you by Yellow Images, the premium graphic assets marketplace. Get access to high-quality mockups, PNG images, creative fonts, and more to save time on your presentations. Wow your next client by heading over to yellowimages.com and snag a 20% discount using our limited-time promo code UIBREAKFAST20. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Jane.
Thanks so much for finding time again. We spoke last time a couple months ago for the Better Done Than Perfect podcast, and I feel we left such a chunk of things uncovered that we're meeting again here to just absolutely decompose the topic of the interviews. Are you up for it?
Oh, I can't wait. I'm so excited. Thanks for having me back.
So for people who have not listened to your previous interviews, give us a few sentences of context, what you do and what you're up for these days.
I work with SaaS companies to help them understand what's next. So there are a lot of different ways that this question manifests. So what do we build next? Which problem do we solve next? Which problem is really causing us the most pain? And that involves a lot of research, a lot of strategic planning and facilitation. And one of the core components is using a variety of different qualitative research methods. One of the most significant is jobs to be done research. And the practice of jobs to be done research helps us understand what's going on in our customers' world in the moments before they join our context or before they join our world. What's their context when it meets our context? And helping SaaS leaders understand what's next, a huge component of what we're doing is getting better at understanding our customers, getting better at understanding how we can use that understanding of our customers to build things that are helpful for them that also help the business. So I will work with companies to execute jobs to be done research projects, to help with research ops engagements, to see how we can mobilize insights that already exist and instead of letting them get lost in the shuffle. And also training people who are new to jobs to be done, helping people get really good at doing those interviews. How do you ask really good questions? What are your own unique tendencies that you might be able to really boost up and get better insights out of? And what are some things that you may want to work on? So a lot of jobs to be done research.
It's definitely not the first time we're talking about jobs to be done here on the show. And one of the latest episodes on the topic was with the great Jim Kaulbach, who wrote a book on the topic. But for those who are new, just briefly a couple sentences of what jobs to be done method is about.
Jobs to be done is a backward-looking documentarian style research to understand what happened before people did something. What happened means what they actually did, the choices that they made, the trade-offs that they weighed, and also who they talked to, what they felt, where they were, what the weather was like. Really getting a full understanding of the context, the external factors, the internal factors that people consider before they make a decision. So we have so many frameworks at our disposal in our work. There are personas, there's jobs to be done. There are different types of personas, archetypes, I think is one. Oh, I heard another new one recently. There's the hero's journey. There's so many different ways that we can understand and characterize the types of people who we're working with, the types of people who we're selling to. What many of those frameworks depend on is a static understanding of who it is that you're speaking to. So if you're selling a tool for designers, cool. A designer might be your persona. A design lead might be your persona. A product designer might be. And all of that is valid. There's often personas and archetypes get pitted against jobs to be done fairly often. I'm guilty of this as well. But personas kind of tell you what world you're in, and jobs to be done tells you a little bit about how that world works and what changes. So where our persona is static and largely unchanging, the jobs to be done element will tell you what does change and helps you see how people make progress. Because somebody comes to you and they may be a designer when they show up, and they're a designer when they become your customer, and they may remain a designer for the duration of their relationship with you. But what can you do with that information? You work with designers, and designers might have different problems and needs, but those problems and needs change over time, especially as they're making progress with you. So what Jobs to be Done does is tell you, help you understand how those people, those personas, those archetypes, the people in your world are on this journey. What are the things that are changing for them as they go? But the part on static versus dynamic, I've often worked with clients where there are existing personas and people are building for the personas without understanding how those personas change over time. And what Jobs to be Done and does, much like what a hero's journey does, is say, how do our personas change over time as people make progress?
When it comes to sort of understanding the larger picture, what kind of insights are we looking for? Are we looking at? One thing that comes to mind is a subclass of the Jobs to be Done interviews, the switch interviews, when you need to figure out the purchasing situation when people are finally ready to purchase your product or what they do there. I don't know. Another example of what we might be looking for is just overall feelings about something. I'm putting things together on the fly now, but do you have more systematic idea of what we should be looking for with such interviews?
Yeah. The way that I'll describe a Jobs to be Done research study is to say that it's like having a camera. You're a documentarian, you're making a film, and you can point that camera just about anywhere you want to point it. As long as you're looking at things that have already happened, maybe things that are happening in real time. I guess documentaries don't really look so much past tense. But you can point that camera anywhere. And that's the first component of really saying, what kind of research study are we going to do? So one of the things that we'll dig into, or one of the things I'm really excited to talk about with you today, are how to run really, really good interviews and get really, really good data and walk away saying, aha, I know what's happening with my customers. Nobody else knows this. I have this magical knowledge now. And the first component of a really successful study is deciding what's the research question that you want to ask. And the research question is going to be different from the actual questions that you ask. So to your point, like you said, there are switch interviews. People are behaving in one way, they switch their behavior and start behaving in another way. That's a designing a study to say, how do we uncover that kind of question? Why did people switch is one kind of study. And you're not necessarily going to ask people, well, why did you switch, when you get them on the call? Because it's a little bit tricky to answer a question straight out like that. In addition to switch interviews, I often find myself doing Jobs to be Done studies when I'm looking at when people have not adopted a solution like ours. So what's the subset of users who were using one of our competitors or using a competitive alternative? A lot of times it might be somebody who's using a spreadsheet or they have an intern. April Dunford talks a lot. She's a positioning consultant, and she talks extensively about how your competitive alternatives are not only the products in your category. It's anything that could be used as an alternative to solving the problem that your product solves. So we often will see people switch from having the intern or having the spreadsheet to using our tool. But at the same time, it's also really interesting to say, hey, what about people who are still using those groups and they're dissatisfied or still working with those categories of competitive alternatives and they're dissatisfied for one reason or another and they haven't switched to us? Maybe they even haven't even made the switch yet. So how do we understand what's going on in their world? And so when you do an investigation with a group like that, you can really get an idea of what they're considering just in the moment before they might enter your context, just before they say, hey, I guess I could Google a product that does something like what I need. And this is a really fun intersection into the stages of awareness, which I think we may have spoken about on Better Done Than Perfect. I'm not sure. But the stages of awareness are a huge part of conversion copywriting, which is my background. And you can be unaware, which means you don't even know you have a problem. You can be pain aware, which means I know I have a problem, but I'm not sure how to solve it. You can be solution aware, which means I know solutions exist for this problem, but I don't know what they are. And you can be product aware. I know about XYZ product. And then most aware, I know about XYZ product as a solution to my problems and how to solve them. So one of the things that we can look at when we're doing our studies is to say, am I looking at somebody who's switched to my product and is most aware of who I am, hopefully, if they're a customer, hopefully they're aware of what they're doing. But you can also look at people who have not yet switched and maybe lower awareness. And that's where a lot of your marketing efforts may be focusing anyway, helping more people become more aware of the problem that they have or that you're a solution to their problem. It can help you uncover where they're hanging out. Where are they listening to podcasts? Are they in Facebook groups? How have they tried to solve this problem? And how can you step in and be the solution right then? Another kind of, I will also often do investigations at key revenue milestones. So the moment when someone switches from what they have been doing in the past to what they're doing now, that's around acquisition and activation. You can also look at what's happening when somebody has started using a key feature that maybe is correlated with 6-month retention, or maybe it's something that you just launched. And then you can also look at what's happening right after people stop using your product, which is another kind of switch interview. These ones are different. There's a lot of emotion sometimes here. And sometimes this kind of emotion can be a little bit the opposite problem that we often face, where people don't want to share too much. They're so overcome with emotion that it's hard to get into like the really nitty gritty of where you messed up. So those are some of the different places where I like to recommend doing research. Oh, and you can also do it when you're saying, hey, do we want to evaluate a new customer segment, a new category, a new type of user? Maybe we serve designers, but our product could also help developers. What's going on in their world? Let's understand what they do and how they solve this problem. And are there similarities? Can we say, hey, a designer and a developer, what their day job is effectively doesn't matter as long as they have this other, they're on the same story. They're hiring us for the same job to be done. Maybe, maybe not.
This is a great lineup of use cases. And it shows all the whole array of opportunities that our listeners could use research interviews for. And I must admit, I come super prepared for this conversation today, because between our last talk at Better Done Than Perfect and today, in December 2020, I personally conducted 22 interviews for UserList, and I talked to people who are not our customers, and we tried to uncover what's going on in their world, et cetera, just per your textbook example, what you mentioned before. And I should admit that doing is vastly different from just listening to advice.
For sure.
I was very equipped, but it was still pretty challenging. Let's walk through the first couple stages that happened before the interview, such as recruiting the people, designing what you're going to do, and then we'll dive into the actual speaking part.
Excellent. One of the things that makes interviews the most successful is having set up everything that you need to run a really successful interview beforehand. And the biggest component is designing the study, deciding what question you want to ask. And just like we were discussing, knowing before you sit down with somebody what your objective is, if you're trying to understand why they switch, why they have been successful, it's a tight balance, or it's a balance between going in and saying, this is the question that we're trying to answer, and also saying, we can't possibly know what we're going to find until we start talking to people. So we don't want to restrict ourselves too much. So loosely pegging the scope of what you're trying to understand to a moment in time, a decision that was made, an outcome that you know was achieved or not achieved. That's the first and most important part of your study, really deciding what it is that the goal and objective is. And that leads right into the next component, which is, in my opinion, the most difficult part of doing research, which is recruitment. And recruitment has two different stages. And the first is deciding who you want to talk to. So if you say, we want to talk to really successful users who have onboarded, who have activated, they joined our world, and they're here to stay. That leads to the question of, well, how do we know that? How do we know that they're successful? How do we know that they're onboarded and activated? And maybe you have a metric that says, this is how we measure activation. This is how we know people are making progress with us. You may select people who have met that metric and consider no other criteria. You may say, hey, you know what else? We want to really look at people who meet this criteria and who also happen to be the top 10% most engaged users, or the people who send the fewest support tickets, or people who send a lot of support tickets. So in doing that, you may find that you're inadvertently selecting for some other criteria without realizing it. I have done I recruited participants where we knew the activation metric. We were pretty sure we understood what success meant. And with the criteria that we had, we ended up recruiting a bunch of people who happened to match a single persona. They had a single characteristic that they shared, and we didn't get anybody else. So we hadn't been looking for it, but we happened to design a study that really only looked at one segment of our audience, which is one of the reasons why recruitment and designing a study can be so challenging and so overwhelming when you're coming at it new and fresh, because it's really hard to know if you're designing it in a way that's going to help you get the answers that you want. The best way to mitigate this risk is to be pretty candid with yourself that it's existing as you're going through, as you're setting up who you want to speak with. The first couple of times you do it, over time, you'll probably get really good. Over time, you'll probably be able to say, okay, I can tell that we may be introducing some kind of metric that means one thing or another. But initially, it's going to feel a little weird, and you're probably going to get some people in there who you weren't expecting, who setting up some bias. So knowing that it could be happening and knowing that you're still going to get really good insights, but you may need to categorize them differently later on. That's how I like to mitigate that. Then the actual recruitment process can usually go one of two ways. And this is so dependent on factors that may be totally outside of your control. If your audience contains researchers, contains designers, contains people who are typically active online and speaking verbosely and in that pattern of sharing their research, of doing research, you're very likely to have a much easier time because it's familiar, it's comfortable. It's easier to recruit people who kind of know what research already is. It's also easier to recruit people when you have a strong relationship. So there are some products that may have maybe like a set it and forget it type situation where people set it up, they pay you every month, they're very satisfied, they don't need to log in, everything's working great. They probably forget about you. Maybe you're just a disembodied company that charges their card every month. This is the hardest group to recruit from, because what I have seen from companies that have relationships with their customers like this is that it's really difficult to get a response from anybody. The last kind of group that I have seen to be really difficult to recruit from is anyone in security or information security. I've had a couple of clients in this industry, and it's very, very difficult to get anyone on the phone to speak openly about just about anything. So what can you do? There are a couple of different things you can do. It depends on, again, on your relationship and your budget, whether or not you recruit someone and you email them and say, hey, can we talk? Maybe that's enough. You may recruit people and want to send some kind of incentive, like a $50 Amazon card. If you really struggle to get people from your own customer pool, I also recommend tools like userinterviews.com. User Interviews is based in the US. There's another company based in Europe where you can go and they'll help you recruit participants, and you can set up screener questions for people to match the type of people that you're looking for. And even so, you can end up in a situation where you find everybody that you need who meets your criteria in a couple of days, or it could take a couple of months. It kind of varies from company to company.
When you're designing the study and figuring out what you're going to ask, is it usually tied to the business decision you're hoping to make with the help of this research? Are you allowed to make any assumptions there? Or do you try to make it as open-ended as possible? Well, you mentioned there is a balance, but still, do you take the end goal in mind?
Yeah, of course. So if you, for example, if you're considering building a new feature, so this gets into a really interesting question, which is where do new ideas come from? How do we decide what we want to build? And a lot of times they'll come only from research. Sometimes an executive will pop into a meeting and say, I want this, and scramble to make it happen. And then there's other times where your product managers are just noticing things that are happening, and maybe people are making a request and you want to understand that more. Those are situations where you can use Jobs to be Done to understand a specific question and whether you want to build something specific while still bearing in mind the core understanding of Jobs to be Done, or underpinning rather, which is you don't know what the answer is before you start. So we don't go in saying, I have this idea for this thing I want to build. I want to validate it. I want to validate my idea. I want to see if people are going to say they would use something like this. Instead, this is a situation where you might want to say, okay, I'm considering building I have a standing desk. I want to know if I should offer a keyboard tray underneath my standing desk. I'm not going to ask people, would you get a keyboard tray? What I want to know is, in other situations where people have bought keyboard trays or have not bought keyboard trays, what was their experience like? What choices did they make? What trade-offs did they make? What other alternatives did they consider? Did they get a keyboard tray because their desk wasn't adjustable? Did they get a keyboard tray because they wanted to be able to step back and be a little further away from their desk and have more space? Did they get a keyboard tray because they had, maybe they are more accustomed to having things on their desk all the time, so they just ran out of room? We don't know what their reasons for purchasing a keyboard tray are. We don't know what job they hired a keyboard tray to do. So if we're considering adding a keyboard tray to our product line, we can investigate that question. We can say what's happening here without saying, should we do this? The question is less, should we do this? It's more, what can we understand about this situation when something similar has been hired by other people to do a job?
And yeah, the key insight here is that should we build the keyboard tray is like the worst question you can ever ask, because people, first, they are afraid to hurt you. And second, they don't even ever understand themselves, not to mention what they are going to do. It should always be about the past, right?
Yes. Yes. The number one, this is great. We design our study, we recruit our study, we're taking this really specific approach. Maybe we want to understand something really specific. How do we start to ask what those questions are? And the number one rule, if you pause this interview now and you go on with your day and you learn nothing else, the number one rule is only ask past tense questions. You can also ask present tense questions, but never ask future tense questions. We don't want to know if people say they would do something. We don't want to know their opinion of whether they think we should do something. We don't want to know whether they could do something in the future. Everything is in the past or in the present, depending on what you're asking about. Because jobs to be done is not about predicting the future. Jobs to be done is about understanding what's already happening. And somebody telling you what has already happened for them in the past is going to give you an understanding of what will happen in the future for other people who enter your context. So you still get an understanding of how the future could look for you, but you can't ask for it. You're right. If people are going to lie because they want to be nice, and even in addition to that, we don't really have a good way of answering that. What would you do if we started selling a keyboard tray? Well, I don't know. What color is the keyboard tray? How big is it? Will it fit my keyboard? Is there a spot to put the cord? I don't know. How can I possibly answer that question? I don't have the information. So we want to avoid questions like that first and foremost.
Do you decide what questions to ask when designing the survey or the conversation or on the fly?
A little bit of both. So because every interview has a similar format in that I'm trying to understand something that happened, there are a few questions that I'm going to ask over and over and over and over again. They'll get adjusted based on what somebody has told me. Before each interview, I'll typically sit down and write out some questions that I want to make sure that I address, or I uncover questions that I want to address given the study. There's not too many. There's not too much that I'm really doing to understand, or not too much that I'm writing down ahead of time. So here's how I like to think about jobs to be done interviews. I like to start by saying, tell me a little bit more about something that happened. Tell me a little bit more about how you started your business. Tell me a little bit more about how you bought your first desk. Tell me a little bit more about how you're planning that office renovation, redecoration. From there, there's really two main questions that I will ask over and over again, which is, and then what happened? Tell me more about that. And then what happened? Tell me more about that. On repeat, over and over and over again, with getting a little bit more and more specific to what's actually happening. So by that, I mean, someone says, okay, well, I bought an apartment because I needed a place to work quietly. Oh, tell me more about that. And let's get even more specific, where did you buy the apartment? What kind of noise were you experiencing that made you feel like enough was enough? Was there anything that happened? Do you live with people? How many people? Do you have any animals? What's your work schedule? What time of day do you work? How many different types of, or are you facing the street? Do you face a garden? Where's the noise coming from? And I haven't even given, there's no space there even to answer, but that's a line of questioning. Could be enough to get a lot of really juicy insight, or it might not be. So the other thing is that there are just like there's two types of people, two types of audiences. People are like, yes, interview me, and people who you're going to struggle with. There are people you'll get on a call and they'll be so effusive that you'll ask them two or three questions and that'll be it. Like, you won't really have to ask them too much more because they're going to maybe some of your podcast guests are like this. Maybe even some of the ones named Allie. So they're going to just keep talking and talking and talking. So that's how they communicate. That's, they have a lot that's in there, in their minds and brains and hearts that they want to share. And then there's also going to be people who are not like that. They're not going to be to get on the phone and just vomit everything out. There's a lot of differences in how individuals communicate and how different expectations of communication are in different parts of the world. So you may get on the phone and you may find that people are just not giving you much to go off of. So that line of questioning that I say about getting a new apartment so that you can reduce the noise, you might need to ask all of those questions in a 5 to 7 minute span because you might only get one word answers, or that you may not get to all of them. So what I like to, the main area where I will like to make sure I have some notes down, and this is kind of for myself to, so I feel really prepared to dig in and push back, is when people are going to give you one word answers, because at some point everyone's going to give you a one word answer. Maybe they haven't thought about it, is a set of techniques and follow up questions to say, how do I keep digging? Somebody tells me, oh, it was loud in my office and they stopped talking. What do you do with that? That's not enough. It was loud. Well, we're talking about noise, soundproofing curtains. So of course we know it's loud. We knew that going in. That doesn't help us. So how do we get a little bit further? Loud.
Tell me more
about that. Yeah. And even then you might get, oh man, it's probably 1 in 10 interviews is someone will be like, well, it's, you know, my kids are home, so it's loud. Tell me more about that. Well, you know, it's quarantine. Tell me more about that. Well, so in that case, you could run into a spot where you get on this loop of no one's really, it's like, give me more information. So in that case, I'd like to say, if they're not going to give me lots of words right off the bat in the question that I ask, if they're not feeling super verbose, what are some things I can pick apart there? So, okay, your kids are home. How old are your kids? Are they in school? Who's watching your kids when you're not in your office? And what are their responsibilities? If the detail that you give me is there's kids at home, it's quarantine, and there's noise, then I know I can ask more follow-up questions on kids, on quarantine, on noise, and really anything that relates to the household. Any factor that could possibly be affecting what it's like to be working from home gives me a lot of other questions. Now, eventually you may realize that you're on the phone with somebody who could be a dud. Sometimes the interviews are a dud and you don't get anything. But more than likely, if you keep pushing, you're eventually going to get to something where somebody really starts to open up. So what I will do sometimes is write down questions like, if I hear, especially if you're interviewing 10 people and you've done one or two interviews that have been really productive, you can write down some of the words that were really interesting that led you down additional paths. So somebody says loud or horns honking, traffic noises, little kids. Maybe there's a difference between school age kids and babies. I don't know. I don't really know anything about children. So that's being able to really push on those one word answers with questions. The other thing that I like to do in that scenario is to sit silently. Someone gives you one word answer, just sit, count to 3 or 5 or 10. They're going to keep talking again. Yeah, eventually. And I'm sure you know this from podcasting is sometimes people just give a one word answer and they expect the conversation to move on from there. But if you let them sit in that silence very often, they'll kind of tell you more. And it may not even be answering a question that you would have thought to answer. So when someone does give you a one word answer, it can be kind of, sometimes you're really on your way to getting some good stuff. The third kind of thing that I like to prepare for, there's people who don't give you much by not saying much. And then there's people who don't give you much by saying a lot of words that are really not touching on the level of depth that you're interested in, that you really want to know. So sometimes people might tell you things and it gives you a fairly good outline of what happened. And I did this one demonstration where so one of the things that I'll do with teams or workshops or event organizers is a demonstration of a jobs to be done interview. I'll interview somebody, and while we're doing the interview, I'll have everyone else take notes and do a clustering exercise and see what they hear. And it's good practice to say, okay, if I'm in a jobs interview, what should I listen for? And then we can do some analysis afterwards. And I was doing one of these with a team, and one of the participant, we were talking about headphones, purchasing, I think, wireless headphones. He said he bought these two headphones and The first one, it was really interesting. He got a pair of headphones because he had had the brand before. Then he got another. Then he realized that he couldn't wear them all day. They weren't designed for something like that. But he didn't really know how to shop for something that was designed for wearing all day. And then the decision that the decision patterns that he was telling me ultimately didn't map to the actions that he was taking. And it took a lot of digging and a lot of asking follow-up questions to really understand that, which brings up another important thing, which is that it's very hard to get much good stuff in the first half hour. So it's a very common practice to schedule interviews for 30 minutes. My experience is that you get most of the good stuff between hours 45 and hour 60 towards the end of really getting into it. So I like to allow the first half hour of asking questions. I'm getting background. They're sharing background, but it's almost like a warm-up exercise. We're still getting comfortable with each other. We're still really starting to understand what the conversation's about. Because it might start off as, well, I had this one brand of headphones and I got another brand of headphones, but that's not what's happening. What's happening is your entire world has changed because the entire world has changed for everyone. But you've had this conversation so many different times on a surface level. Have you really had it on this one deep level, specifically related to how you're having your meetings with anyone? I don't know. But maybe you've had it so many times that at this point, it just feels rote. It feels like you're repeating yourself. So we really have to dig really deep into it. You need to feel comfortable with me to be able to share what was happening. And I need to be able to really probe and say, are you sure that's what was happening? So by the end of it, we were able to make a lot of progress, but it was a demonstration and we didn't have a lot of time. So we ended up having to cut it off, but I could tell there were another 5 minutes and we really, really would have had some good stuff.
I can share a little bit of my experience with the founder interviews that we did. And I was just not in the position in the end of the year to ask for like 50 minutes of their time. So I asked for 20. And of course, I knew that's not going to be much, but it was still better than nothing. Of course, I was hoping for 30. So a good tip is to not schedule these back by back so that if somebody feels particularly expressive, you can still like go over another 10 or something minutes. And use this time to make detailed notes after that while you're still fresh with the memories. And that's totally true that it's very hard to uncover much with those 20 minutes. You can scratch the surface, but still better. There is this textbook interview with that JobMaster did on jobs to be done. I think on Business of Software, it's available on YouTube. We're going to link to that. It's about how a guy bought a car. And it was very interesting to watch it as an example, but it feels so unrealistically long and slow. And like, you're never going to get that slow and that detailed in real life. Are there any tips on getting to the meat faster, like to those insights, if you have limited time? I know this kind of contradicts your idea of long interviews, but you know, reality and what we want is not always the same thing.
Well, if you're meeting someone new and you're getting to know them, maybe they're going to be a friend, maybe a partner, can you reasonably expect that that process can be accelerated in a really healthy way? I think most of the time the answer is no. So you may, you know, we meet people and we feel like, oh, I click with this person. I want to be friends with this person. I'm going to start hanging out with this person. We're going to do fun things together. But to really get to that depth of having a real relationship, it takes time. And that's kind of how it is for jobs interviews as well. It takes a lot of time. You're talking to a stranger and you're also bringing in who you are. They're bringing in who they are. And that plays a role too. So we can write down our questions, but how we ask them, the mood we're in, the mood they're in, whether we've had our coffee, whether we're from the same part of the world, gender dynamics, there are a lot of different factors that can play into how well we're able to communicate, how accustomed to sharing things we might be with one another. So it's very, very difficult. Now, that's not to say, I mean, to have a 20-minute conversation is still better than no conversation, while at the same time, I would also put a caveat that there are ways. It's important to do research as long as you keep the principles in place. So as long as you're still saying, I'm not asking would, could, should, I'm trying to understand what happened, you may not get to that deep emotional level, but you still might say, okay, you know, all these people learned about me from a podcast, or they all ask their friends for help, or they all used to use this other competitor and then they switched because they were missing a feature. You're still going to learn some of the plot points, but you may not walk away with the feeling, like watching a documentary that says, like, here are the things that happened, that cut out all the parts where, you know, you get to see the baby animals learning how to crush a rock on a nut for the first time. So anyway, to the extent that you can, I always recommend longer conversation. You know, you can ask for it. They can say no. They may not, you know, some, not everyone's going to sign up for a 60-minute interview or even a 30-minute interview, but a lot of times you can still ask. Worst they say is no.
One of the things that really helped me was to have a good opening question that was applicable to everyone by default, because often you come into this interview a little bit overwhelmed because you have like five of them in a day and you rush between, you know, getting things done and sitting down at the desk in time, and you sit down. It's good to have like a trained opening that will warm them up quickly. For example, in our case, it was like, take us back in time when you started out. And every founder is eager to share that. Like, that's not a hard question. So we spent the first warm-up minutes listening to their founder story, and that was a good quick start to a certain extent. But yeah, you're absolutely right that we really shortened the agenda as a result. Like, we had a lot of questions in the notes, and we really deep dive into just a few of them, but relatively well. But yeah. Definitely so.
I think what you just shared is great. So what I like to do is to say, take me back in time, or what I'm going to ask you about a lot of things that have happened in the past. And I'm going to ask you to remember what you thought and felt and feel. And it might feel a little strange. Maybe no one's asked you these questions before, but there's no wrong answer. And the more that you can share with me, the more helpful it is. It's going to help us design better experiences for people like you. It also depends too. If you recruit somebody through a research platform, like user interviews, these are people who are, you know, they know that they're signing up. They're going out of their way to sign up to be a participant in a user research study. So they may be, there's not necessarily a customer relationship there that you're managing. This may or may not be the first interview that they've done. So you can say, you know, everybody in the room knows you're there for user research and that they're going to be asking you some questions. When you're speaking to somebody you're not recruiting from a tool like that, from somebody who's in your customer base. Yeah. Take me back in time to a moment when XYZ happened, preview that you're going to be asking about thoughts and feelings. A lot of people may not, there's still going to be a chuckle the first time you ask somebody about what they really felt, especially if it's like, yeah, like feelings, like the headphones, feelings about buying headphones. It's not something that is generally part of the discourse. You might say we like headphones, we don't like them. Oh, they work great, they don't work great. But to talk about your feelings related to that well, it may incite a chuckle, even if you've already previewed that you're going to be asking about feelings.
Tell us how to remove your bias while asking questions, and especially when analyzing results. So we're going to be drifting in the section of like how you interpret what you've just learned.
Oh, this is the hardest part. So I would say first, it is almost impossible for any human to completely remove their own bias and their own self from anything. So that said, there's a lot that you can do to practice being non-judgmental, because you're here to learn and understand and explore. And depending on the type of, so most of our listeners are working with software companies. A great number are going to be working with B2B software companies. The thoughts and feelings that you uncover when you're talking about headphones or the sale of CRM or business tools are likely going to be different than the thoughts and feelings that you uncover when you're working in other areas of research. So one of the emerging calls to action is for better mental health care for people who do user research, especially in communities where people may be telling you about serious traumatic things that have happened. There may be people, and when you're designing government services, you're speaking with anyone in the general population. You're designing experiences around how to safeguard your identity, designing experiences around how to protect yourself. Doing research in these populations can be very, it's impossible to remove your experience of being a human, hearing about another human's difficult experience from that. The framework of saying, tell me more about that, and making sure that you're not really interjecting your own reaction is one of the best ways to do that. Trying to keep your face relaxed, it kind of depends too. So my natural face is kind of smiling and bubbling and nodding, and like my eyes are wide and I'm like, yeah, I have a very active listening face on, and being mindful of how, if I'm changing the face and if I furrow my brow or I make some kind of, if I have some kind of visual reaction that can indicate judgment to the person that I'm speaking with, that may cause them to clam up a little bit, which we don't want to happen. So trying to keep a relatively consistent, non-reactive body language to the extent that you can. Again, there's no, you're a human talking to another human. So it's impossible to take that out of the equation.
So my co-founder, Claire, she was mentoring me how to do these calls, and she did a drill on me. So I was the interviewee and she was asking me about ESPs, something. And then what she kept doing was sort of summing up my thoughts after each question and then asking more. And I was like, Claire, but you know, the drill is to sort of, I thought the drill is to shut up and let the person talk, like not try not speak for them. But she said that it's an effective technique to recap their thoughts to make sure you interpret them correctly. And a lot of times they will say no because something else, and then real stuff starts to emerge. So that was one of the interesting techniques for me.
Yes. Oh yeah. That's a really great point. So recapping what somebody said and making sure you got it right is also a great way to keep the conversation moving, to keep that momentum, to introduce a pause to let somebody else catch their breath. Because again, it's a conversation between two people, and as much as we want their voice to be the one that matters, that doesn't mean we can't use ours to support them in sharing their experiences. And like Claire says, when you recap what somebody has said, not only does that help you make sure you understand what they said, you're not interjecting your own opinion. You're saying, it sounds like this is what's happening. This is what you said. Do I have that right? Or did I get that? And this can be a really helpful and powerful facilitation technique for them to say yes, but even more powerful them to say, well, actually, now that you mention it, and give you something a little bit more. And this is kind of just like in human, like in conversation with a friend, if you do something like this, you may hear them come back to you and say, you know, well, actually the real thing that's bothering me, I know I told you about all these facts, but the real thing that's bothering me is this other thing that's happening. And that recap is, yeah, that's a really, really good technique. I agree.
One of the fun facts was that we were talking about, you know, email and what they use for their email lists and everything. And not once, but more like a few times, what happened was we had this, you know, decent conversation. And then as we're closing, they were like, oh, I thought we got here to talk about email. And by the way, we're also using like MailChimp. And then they literally forgot to tell me about the whole like section of their business, of their marketing setup. And like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And then we have another 5 minutes on that. And that's pretty fascinating how you can really omit things when you think you have the full picture. That's really strange to me.
Yeah. I heard a long time ago, I don't remember the source, I wish I did, that in therapy, they call these doorknob moments. When the patient gets up off the couch, they've been talking about themselves for the last hour, and they go over to the door, and as they're leaving, and they say, well, you know, doc, it just so happens that there's this other thing, which goes back to your other point of making sure that you have a nice solid buffer time afterwards. Because, okay, so I always recommend that you record and transcribe interviews because you're going to get the full raw data, and don't stop recording until the call has ended and they've hung up. Because I didn't used to do it this way, but I would end the call and they and say, all right, well, great. That was awesome. Thank you for your help. And they would be like, yeah. Well, and now there's this other thing that I want to mention. Hey, turn on the recorder. So I think this is part of like setting it's almost, I guess, meeting design is one way to put it. But the way that you and I are speaking now, we know we're being recorded. We're speaking fairly similarly and about fairly similar topics too when we were briefing before we got on the call, and as I'm sure we'll do after the recording is over. But it's a little bit different in the quality, because I'm a little nervous. I know lots of people are listening, and you have a job to do because you're a professional interviewer. So you know that there are ways to ask questions. Whereas we get off the phone and we can kind of bumble through and start and stop our sentences, and it doesn't matter because that's part of conversation. You want to make sure that you capture that, because you can be in an interview when someone feels like they're in the hot seat. they're in the hot seat and it's hard to break that psychology. So when you have that moment of ending the conversation, letting the conversation happening when the official quote unquote part is over can be, you can get some good stuff there.
Ellie, we really need to be wrapping this up. And I know we have one part hanging for analyzing the interviews, but I'll leave this, you know, as a question mark for maybe the next time we ever meet or something like that. Because I mean, there is no way we can talk about that in less than half an hour. So as we're wrapping this up, what final piece of encouraging advice can you give to people who are really scared to run interviews? Because this is really very scary altogether.
So if you can with yourself, if you're finding yourself very scared, what I would recommend is turning a lot of this job's work inward. So, okay, this is the first time I have to do a jobs interview. What's this like? What am I experiencing? What am I feeling? Why is it scary? What is it that I'm really, truly afraid will happen? And is that a real risk? Is that bad if it happens? But the absolute worst thing that happens in most situations is the interview is weird and you don't get anything and everyone walks away feeling a little bit awkward. And maybe that ruins the day. Maybe it ruins the week. But that's it. It's a bad social encounter. And we all have those. For me, I mean, that's when I first started I felt that way. So I would look at what you're really scared of and see if there's a way that you can try to understand that fear and work through it and see if there's anything you can do to mitigate it. And then in the absolute worst case scenario, what I would say is just allow yourself to have 10 bad interviews where all you're trying to do is feel comfortable and not scared and just practice doing it. It's going to feel weird the first 10 times you do it. So say, all right, that's my goal. I'm going to do 10 weird interviews. And then when I've done 10 weird interviews, then I'm going to see how I feel.
That's great advice. Is there any reading our listeners can do on the topic? Of course, I cannot stop referencing to Rob Fitzpatrick's The Mom Test, which was very helpful to me before I did mine. Anything else, maybe more academic for you as a professional researcher?
So what I recommend in particular for people working in SaaS, you want to learn jobs to be done, is anything by your co-founder, Claire Swellentrop. She has given several great talks on jobs to be done research. I saw a talk she gave at MicroConf, the last MicroConf that happened before the pandemic. And it was so good. Or maybe it's the one before that. I think it's the one before that. And I know she speaks about that in her work with Elevate as well. And she digs into a lot of the theory and the practice on, okay, what are we doing here? What's a persona? How do we have these two different things interacting with each other? And she also has a lot of good visual metaphors for what it is. So she does a really good job of modeling what jobs are in a way that I find to be really helpful as a peer researcher.
Awesome. Well, that's particularly awesome to hear that our co-founder at UserList is somebody you listen to.
Yeah. Claire's great. Claire's really, really good. I actually, in my MicroConf talk the year after Claire went, so her talk just stuck with me so much. And I was like, oh my gosh, all these founders, like, they're learning about jobs to be done from Claire Swellentrop. This is amazing. They're going to go home and they're going to do all these job studies. And then in that year, I started working with more people and I was like, wow, what I'm starting to notice is that there's this big operational gap. And what I asked the audience in my talk the next year, I said, okay, who was your last year? We know MicroConf has a lot of repeat attendees. A lot of hands go up. All right. Who heard Claire's talk? A lot of hands stay up. Who went home and did some job studies? All the hands go down. And I was like, okay, I understand why this is happening because it's really challenging. And there's a lot of different operational components to do. So in addition to the fear of having the interview, how do I run this interview? How do I have this conversation about people's feelings? There's also, how do I go from not having a research department to doing research when I'm doing a million other things as a founder? And I know Claire's work helps a lot of the current iteration of her work is helping a lot of marketers who may have a little bit more maneuverability. I shouldn't say maneuverability, but the difference between a marketer at a company and a founder of a company in terms of what their day-to-day looks like and how they have to split up their tasks is different. So this is an area of work that's starting to become really interesting to me, because if you want to do something, well, it's kind of like a jobs project. If you know something's important and you want to do it and you believed in doing it and you've heard one of the best people in the world talking about it on stage, giving you a great primer, and you go home and you don't do it. Why not? What happened there? Tell me more. So that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, there is different dynamic. If you're doing it yourself as a founder, one of the pieces of advice you gave me before was like, don't try and combine like this with doing other work because you'll naturally be very exhausted. And that's very true. The other thing you can do, you can delegate it. For example, last summer we had a marketing engagement with Asia Matos, now Rangio, of Demand Maven. So she did some customer interviews with our existing users. And the, it was great because she was less biased and more detached from that. And that was its own genre. And I did these and that was another genre. So I guess each of that works if you have either time or money or something to dedicate to that.
Yeah, that's, and that's such a great point too, because you, who you are as a person is also your relationship to the conversation that you're having. So if you're having a conversation about your business, it's a little harder for you to dig maybe, and it might be a little harder for people to share their feedback. But Asia's great, and Asia's really, her work's awesome. And I know when you have somebody coming from the outside who can take that perspective of saying, okay, here I am. I'm helping this company make get this understanding and understand what's happening. We're going to use it to help more people like you, but ultimately you're not going to hurt my feelings. You're not going to, what you say to me is you're giving me data versus you're telling me about the business that I started. That's my baby. So it it sets up a little bit of a different dynamic for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Ellie. Where can people find you and your work online?
My work is at ellieblum.com, and I set up a page with a little bit more to come. Hopefully, we'll see. I set up a page, ellieblum.com/JTBD, with some of the things that I do to help companies introduce their teammates to jobs to be done research, get better at doing research, and to do some of the research for them.
Amazing. Thanks for your time. It was an amazing interview, and I hope it's valuable to our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a wonderful rest of your week.
You too.